what David wanted me to do is to give an update on the quantum gravity program based on quantum geometry. And a lot of stuff has happened recently in the last couple of years, and I cannot cover it all. So what I will do is to give, first of all, an introduction as to what is quantum geometry, because not everybody may know about it, and then give you two applications. And these applications are to Big Bang, to quantum cosmology, and to black holes. And again, as usual in these lunches, you know, there may be lots of discussions and people may stop me, so we'll just see how much I can cover. So therefore, I thought it would be better to give sort of a more detailed references. There are reviews. There's a review by Thiemann. It's last year's, you know, I'm not sure whether it is 03 or 02 actually, yeah. But anyway, there's a review of by Thiemann's, which is very good. It's not completely up to date. That's why I think it might be 02. Then there is a review that Jurek Lewandowski and I are writing, and it should be ready this summer. We'll put it on net, and that would be up to date. And here we're trying to give really a self-contained treatment so that anybody who wants to learn about this from scratch, so to say, can learn. That was the point of this review. It's self-contained. And then there are two papers on quantum cosmology that I've listed. I will explain what these are in a minute. And one sort of a web little 5-6 pages, 10 pages article on black holes, which summarizes in general term what has happened in black holes with quantum geometry. Okay, so let me begin then with the motivation. So basically, the talk has four parts. I'll begin with a very brief motivation. A little bit, I'll tell you introduction to quantum geometry, and then we'll go to these two applications. So motivation is basically the following. The viewpoint here is very much that general relativity teaches us, or taught us, that gravity is coded in geometry, and therefore any quantum theory of gravity in particular should be also a quantum theory of geometry. And so the question is really, the viewpoint is therefore that we should not really start with a continuum flat background space-time or any continuum space-time in the background, but rather we should let everything be born quantum mechanically. Not only matter, but geometry, both are born quantum mechanically at the same time. Now, another way to look at it, and more fruitful way of looking at this quantum geometry, is really that in classical GR, or classical theories of gravity, modern ones, we have a mathematical language, and that mathematical language is differential geometry. This enables us to formulate field equations, various concepts, etc., that we need. And the question is there a similar mathematical framework, a language that we can use for quantum theories of gravity, background independent? Quantum theories of gravity. So we need something similar, and that replacement, we can call it to be quantum geometry. The word background independent just means that there is no background metric or background fields. At this stage of the program, there is still background manifold. But as if you look at 2 plus 1 gravity, for example, one can see that at the end of the day, one can formulate everything combinatorially and don't really need the background manifold. Background manifold can emerge. But in 3 plus 1 theory, we really do not know. So far, of course, there is an old idea that there should be, at Planck scale, we should not have continuum space-time. There should be some fundamental discreteness. But this, I think, is the first time anyone sees in great detail what specific type of discreteness one is going to have. So in particular, what emerges is that the Planck scale geometry here is really polymer-like. So the fundamental excitations are one-dimensional, and the continuum picture that we get is kind of an approximation which appears when we coarse-grain these fundamental excitations. And the level of mathematical precision is very high here. I mean, it's absolutely clear that there are no hidden infinities. So, for example, I mean, a lot of this work is discussed in mathematics conferences by mathematicians and so on. Now, so far, this quantum geometry has been applied primarily to four-dimensional general relativity. And the idea here is basically that, well, general relativity is the best classical theory that we have. And therefore, if we have a kind of ideas coming from some Planck scale geometry and so on, why not first take the simplest viable theory of gravity that we have and apply it to that and see what happens? Now, of course, first immediate worry that one has to applying it to general relativity would be that there is a perturbative non-renormalizability. And so the question really that we want to find out here, if you like, is a mathematical physics question, to say the least, is whether general relativity can exist non-perturbatively, even though it has these problems perturbatively. Now, there are some minor, there are several examples I can give, but one example that's sort of the simplest to state in a few minutes is just symmetry-reduced models from general relativity. So, for example, you assume that you have got a one killing vector or two killing vectors in vacuum general relativity, and then you can symmetrically reduce it, and you get a low-dimensional gravity theory coupled with matter fields. And these theories have been looked at in great detail, and in particular, there is a very simple model which comes from so-called cylindrical gravitational waves that Carol Kukash had looked at a long time ago. And Monica Peary and I looked at, I don't know, about 5 years ago. We developed it much further. And what we found was that this model is really exactly soluble. So you can actually write down the Hilbert space of states. You can write down the operators. You can write down the quantum metric. You can try to find out ramifications of this quantum metric, et cetera, et cetera. And very recently, there is a group from Madrid. These are Barbero, led by Barbero and Mena, who have looked at this theory again from perturbative point of view. I mean, just pretend you don't know anything. Just take it as a theory that is given to you. You don't know anything non-perturbatively, and just apply perturbative methods. And they find that, in fact, the perturbation theory doesn't converge. And they have very, very nice ideas about how to reach someone. Right. So I think this is recent work, so I do not. Right. There's a big difference, of course.
It doesn't converge. It's no big deal.
Okay. It's order by order. The terms are actually infinite. The question is whether, in fact, it can be. There are only finite number of parameters that are needed in order to make it work or not. In general, if you look at not the simple model, but you look at more general models, then these models are not renormalizable, but they're asymptotically safe. And this is something that has been shown in particular by several people, but particularly Niedermeyer.
These are ones where you just have two killing vectors, so they're effectively two-dimensional?
They're effectively two-dimensional, or they could be, some of them can be actually three-dimensional plus matter field. You could have one killing vector.
Two dimensions is marginal for gravity, so.
Right, but that, there are also models in which there is one killing vector field, and so it could be.
And now, how do your last two points relate? And here you're talking about continuum theories, aren't you?
Right.
So how are these related to the previous point?
To the previous point, this is just supposed to be saying that, well, this is just a very general remark. It's not a very, a detailed remark. It just says that, well, we might worry that there is a problem, and the statement is that, well, some models can be exactly soluble, but may have problems in perturbation theory. And would like to see what happens. This is just not for experts.
These are like two different cures to the problem of
quantum
gravity.
Right.
One is the perturbation theory is not.
Right. Absolutely. They're completely different. So you're absolutely right. So the statement up here that I'm making is that, well, because of this discreteness, the viewpoint really is that, in fact, renormalizability and so on may be an artifact of really discreteness by itself, whereas this asymptotic safety, etc., is really it's another direction to go. So mathematically, this is the question I want to ask now. Mathematically, therefore, the question is, does quantum general relativity exist as non-perturbatively? And if so, is it the case that, in fact, perturbative failure is, at least in large part, attributable to the assumption that we are continuum at all scales, that we ignore the fundamental discreteness that comes up at the Planck scale? Now, there are also a bunch of physical questions, and the physical questions are, physical questions. Now I'm going away from this remark and just making physical question about the specific discreteness. Namely, we would like to know what exactly is the quantum nature of geometry, how does the fundamental discreteness manifest precisely in mathematical terms, for example, in eigenvalues of operators and so on, and what are its ramifications. And in particular, we know that in quantum cosmology, for example, or general relativity in general, there are many kinds of singularities. And one of the questions is, are these singularities resolved somehow? Because we are talking about, if you take into account this fundamental discreteness into account. And the very simple-minded idea is that if you take the hydrogen atom, and if I looked at the ground state energy of the hydrogen atom, classically it is minus infinity. The atoms are classically unstable. And quantum mechanically, however, we get the mass of the electron times e to the fourth upon 2h bar. And basically, h bar is coming to rescue. If h bar goes to zero, we get the classical result. So similarly, the question here is that does something happen, for example, to the Big Bang singularity, that quantum mechanically it is removed. But if you ignore quantum effect, the fundamental discreteness of the quantum scale, then again you will get this Big Bang. And these ideas are realized in some detail, and this is what I would like to tell you about. Finally, this whole idea, this whole approach, is in a real sense complementary to string theory, because over here the emphasis is put much more on background independence and not on unification. Well, string theory gives us a very nice principle to unify all forces of nature. That doesn't happen up here. And I think in some sense these are looking at the problem in complementary ways. So now I'd like to just basically tell you what quantum geometry is all about, very briefly. How does it arrive? And for sort of definiteness, I'll just restrict myself to four space-time dimensions. And there are a lot of people who have contributed to it about, you know, the theory was systematically developed in the mid-90s by, you know, by about a dozen groups, but particularly John Baez, Jerzy Lewandowski, Carlo Rovelli, Lee Smolin have made a lot of contributions to this area. Now, there are several ways to introduce this quantum geometry, and I'll just sort of pick the simplest, and the simplest is via Hamiltonian framework, simplest for my purposes. And the idea here is that you take general relativity, and we only look at, if I focus on the geometric fields, gravitational field, then you can construct a Hamiltonian framework with some basic field variables, A and E. They look like Young-Mills theories, where A is a C2 connection. These are all on free manifold M. And tells you how to parallel transport spinners, basically. And these E's, you can think of that as them being sort of orthonormal triads. They have a certain density weight, but that's not too important for what we're doing. And often, one goes to dual description, and instead of this E, one writes down, just changes its index with a Hodge dual, and write down a bunch of two forms, I. And I's here are just taking values in the Lie algebra of SU2, so they are real SU2 valued. And A's, B, etc., these are space-time, space indices. If you write down Einstein's equation in terms of these variables, then take on a particularly simple form as far as quantization is concerned. And that is why one is looking at a framework of general relativity in terms of these variables. So when you go to quantum theory, which is supposed to give us quantum geometry, What we have is the following. First of all, we're going to have a Hilbert space H. And this is a kinematical Hilbert space in the sense that it is analog of the phase space of general relativity. It's a quantum analog of the state space, the full phase space of general relativity. And we'll be able to formulate quantum Einstein's equation as operators, in terms of operators defined on this Hilbert space, basically. This Hilbert space can be just written as functions of, which are square integral functions of these connections. Technically, you have to consider generalized connections, but and this is a standard thing in field theories, infinite dimensions, that classically you can deal with fields which are smooth. Quantum mechanically, you have to deal with fields which are more generalized, more distribution-like. And they are such that basically, for our purposes, the generalized connections are such that holonomies are completely well-defined objects of that. But for example, products of connections would not be well-defined. But holonomies are well-defined objects. That is the sense in which it is generalized. Basically, what one does is one starts with smooth connections, builds a C-star algebra of holonomies, and then finds a so-called Gelfand spectrum of this C-star algebra. And this A is that Gelfand spectrum of that C-star algebra. And then the very nice thing is that there is a very natural measure, which is diffeomorphism univariant. It's a real measure. It's not a formal measure. It's a regular Borel measure, normalized, which is diffeomorphism invariant on this space up here. So this Hilbert space of states is really completely well defined. And the question is, what do typical states look like? That's what we need to have a feeling for. So what you do is the following. To understand how the typical state looks like, it is going to be based on holonomies. So what you do is, you consider a graph. I mean, forget about these labels up here. Just consider a graph in space with finite number of edges and vertices, but arbitrarily large. And then, with each edge of the graph, if you give me a connection, then with each edge of the graph, I got a holonomy, an element of the group which is defined. So given a connection and a path, I get a group element. Given a connection and this path, I'll get another group element, et cetera, et cetera. So as in lattice gauge series, basically, we are going to consider psi A. Alpha is this graph. And so we're going to consider those functions of connections which depend on holonomies. Let's just call them H. H of E1, H of En. There are N edges, and we just consider H of E1 up to N. So these are functions which depend on the connection only through these holonomies. Now, there are some special nice types of states that you can construct, and these are called spin networks. And these spin network states give us a very nice decomposition of this Hilbert space. Namely, what we have is the total Hilbert space H can be written as a direct sum over all possible graphs in space and some things which I'll explain in a minute. Assignment of half integer J, the blue things, to each edge of the graph, and assignment of something called intertwiners at the vertices of the graph, times H alpha J. And these Hilbert spaces are just finite dimensions. So basically, there is a very convenient decomposition in terms of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and you can think of them as Hilbert spaces of spin systems. So what are elements of this, what are these objects up here? So I have to tell you a bunch of functions.
And so finite graphs.
These are for finite graphs, arbitrarily large but finite graphs. Not necessarily. We're dealing with non-compact spaces. But there are ways of compactifying those spaces in certain ways and defining spin networks, which will actually give you the geometry of the whole space. But at the moment, I mean, at this level, this is not really important. So with respect to spin networks, the typical state N will be given by this is a state like that, N alpha. And as I said, you have to give a half integer to each of these edges, and you have to give yourself a certain object called intertwiner. What integral Wiener does, we'll see in a second, is kind of a matrix, or it's kind of a, it's a tensor basically, sitting up here, tensor in the Lie algebra of SC2. And what you do is the following. Given this holonomy, right, given this holonomy, you can write it as a matrix. So the first holonomy you can write as a matrix, MA1B1. Right? Because you're given a holonomy, therefore you get a group element, and you just look for the representation of that group element in, so this is a SU2 group element, and you just look at the J1 represented as a matrix, the J1 representation. So it is 2J1 plus 1 times 2J1 plus 1 matrix. And so we just do it for each edge, for second edge. Now we've got all these free indices, and we just tie these free indices with these intertwiners. And there will be M intertwiners, where M is the number of vertices. So these are the tensors which just absorb the incoming indices, or they absorb all the indices up here and give you a number. They just enable you to contract the representations which are all coming in at this particular point. I should say that in order to talk about holonomies, I really need to assign a certain orientation to this graph. So we just assign a random orientation. Nothing ultimately depends on the orientation that you have chosen. Okay. So these are sort of very simple objects. And the whole Hilbert space is just, so these objects belong to this Hilbert space, this finite dimensional one. The reason why it's finite dimensional is because if you give yourself, if you give yourself just the graph and you give yourself labeling of these J's, then there are only finite number of intertwiners that you can have. For example, if there's a trivariant edge like that, then there's only one intertwiner we can have. These are the Clebsch-Gordan ones. If it is four-valent, then there are more, and so on and so forth. Therefore, this Hilbert space is just finite dimensional, and the number of dimensions just depends on the number of intertwiners you have. Okay. So now, we'd like to tell you a little bit about operators. And I would like to tell you about kind of basic operators, like our P's and Q operators in quantum mechanics. The first bunch of operators are just holonomies. So if you give me any edge E, I got a holonomy operator. And I can look at its matrix element in any basis, in any representation. And the statement is that this is going to be a function of the connection. And therefore, these are configuration operators.
Have you changed the theory in introducing, in these discrete things? Or is it just somehow a set of states within the original theory?
I didn't have original theory, right? So this is just defining a theory. Right. So we did not have original theory to begin
with. So it's not in the sense that this is not, you're no longer just a canonical GR. This is
canonical GR, but the so-called geometrodynamics of Wheeler and so on, when people look at looking at wave functions of metrics and so on,
right. That
was always very formal in the sense that nobody ever told you what were the wave functions that were allowed, what was the inner product, what was the Hilbert space, and so on. So you can think of this as being... It's not discretization because I'm not using a fixed graph. If I'd use a fixed graph, it would be discretization. You can use this for diffeomorphism and theory theories of connection. So, right, but I'm using all possible graphs.
Yeah.
It's not a all possible graph. And that's why this Hilbert space is so big. States coming from every possible graph is in this Hilbert space. In that sense, it's a continuum thing. There's a lot of very detailed proofs that I have to go into making sure that this really is a meaningful construction.
It's regarded as a subset of the usual Hilbert space, formal Hilbert space. You're including things that would not be independent.
Which are the being?
You're including as separate items, say a graph, and then another graph where you add one line.
Right.
Those are separate states.
That is a states in the first graph. I have excitations which live on the edges of the first graph. I add another edge. Now I get another state possibly, which are on this. Now the problem is there's a consistency that you have to worry about, and this is where all the hard work of math analysis goes in, which I'm not talking about. But that's why it took so long. It's basically that, well, if I did this, but if you give me a state which really I regarded as a state of the bigger graph, but didn't really depend on this edge, And then you just looked at it as a state from the smaller thing, and you do all these operators, you do various construction, I do various construction, do I get the same result? And that's the hard part. When we construct this measure, that was the hard part, to make sure that, in fact, the measure is really independent of all those things. So that, yeah, doing it on any one graph is really taking over in a very straightforward way what one does in lattice gauge series or random lattices or whatever. But making sure that you can glue them all together in a consistent way, the so-called projective limits, that is where the hard work goes in.
So that goes into the measure?
That, well, the measure is one of those things. Because supposing you give me one of these states, and I regard it as a state on the bigger graph, you regard it as a state on a smaller graph, we better get the same answer. And these consistency conditions are severe restrictions on possible measure. And this diffeomorphism natural measure that one has satisfies these consistency conditions. Okay. So these are the configuration operators. They just operate by multiplication. Right? Because this everything depends on the connection. So you just multiply it. Like x hat operating on psi fx is equal to x times psi fx. Then there are going to be the momentum operators. And these momentum operators are going to be constructed out of these objects up here. And this, what we do is the following. If you give me a two surface and a Lie algebra value test field on that two surface, then I can construct a function which is just integral fi times EISP. This is classically, I can construct such a function up here. And these are the objects which then we want to define as quantum operators. Again, we have to make sure that these are all well defined. On one graph it is fine, but you have to make sure that it's a consistent family of operators and so on. And that's where you show that it is indeed the case. So now these operators are defined, as you would think, by the heuristic prescription that E should go to H bar by over I and delta by delta A, using Yagnil's theory. However, in this case, because these are dimensions not coming from gauge theories but from gravity, E is, for example, dimensionless being a triad in our notation. There is actually H bar G here, not just H bar. The Poisson brackets have a G, factor of G in there explicitly. So we get this, we get relations like that. And then we can write down explicitly what the action is. So supposing you give me a surface S, and you give me, and you give me some test field Fi on this surface S, then I have to tell you, how does this operate on a given object like that? So we have got this state here, and here is an operator. Here is an operator associated with S and Fi. And I want to know how this operator is going to grab onto this state. If the state doesn't intersect, if this graph doesn't intersect the surface, I just get zero. If the graph does intersect the surface, then we have to look at vertices, and the non-trivial action is sort of say at these vertices. You look at all the edges which come up, sorry, not vertices, but non-trivial action is on the edges which intersect at these vertices. So given one of these states, you can think of it as being a wave function which depends on n group elements, each group element associated with each of these edges. And so at this edge now, at this vertex, I got three edges coming up here. And then what this E does when you do the careful calculation, it just operates on the first copy and the second copy and the third copy of the group. I mean, there will be lots of other edges up here. It just ignores all those edges, right? Just focuses on these three. E1, E2, E3. And action up here is just by right invariant and left invariant vector fields, as you would expect in gauge theory. And therefore, there is a very, very nice geometrical action of these operators up here. So these are the basic operators. And this form a certain algebra. And then the main thing is that you can then construct, so to say, more complicated or composite operators. When you do that, we have to be sort of careful because formally the products of operators would be divergent, and we have to make sure that what you're writing down is meaningful. And so let me just give an example of the area operator. So if I take the classical function area, you give me this surface S up here, and supposing I divide it up, how do I write this? Well, I can divide it up, this surface, into a bunch of small, like what we do Riemann sum, into a whole bunch of little elements up here. And then you can just take limit n goes to infinity of summation I equal to 1 to n. Big I just labeling the little little surface that we got times square root of, this is just a fact, EI of SI, EJ of SI. So if I take these operators, E, for test fields, I just use the basis in the Lie algebra, tau 1, tau 2, tau 3. And then I just take the trace up here with delta ij. So classically, it is a fact that if in, this is a Riemann sum, it's nothing more profound, that the area is given if, in fact, you take a uniform limit so that the coordinate area goes uniform of any little square up here or little rectangle up here goes to 0. And now we want to write down the corresponding a hat operator. Now, first, this is fine to write down these operators, but it looks at first that there will be going to be a problem in taking the square roots and taking, you know, in actually taking the limit, etc. But the nice thing about the subject is that for all the geometrical operators, like areas, volumes, and lengths, there is no such problem. And area is, in fact, a well-defined operator, and it operates on one of these wave functions, for example, by giving some number times Planck length squared times summation over vertices. And at each vertex, you've got a vertex operator, which is like the which is like the Laplacian on the copy of the group. So basically, at this vertex, we've got three of them. So basically, you are going to take J1 plus J2 minus J3, there is sign convention coming up, a whole squared. That is what it's going to be. So this is not something I'm making up. I mean, we just do this systematically, and you find that there's a very nice operator that comes up. And therefore, this operator has a very nice action. And again, we have to check that it is.
Why is the square root a problem?
Sorry?
Why is it the square root a problem?
Oh, because this is a positive definite. Sorry, thank you. This actually is a positive definite minus this is a positive definite self-adjoint operator. First, you show it's a positive definite, essentially self-adjoint operator on the whole Hilbert space. And then you take its positive square root. Yeah. So again, I mean, hard work went into showing that these operators are all really well defined on the whole Hilbert space, not just on a graph. They satisfy these consistency conditions. So what are the properties? I mean, there are other operators. It's just an illustrative operator. So the typical properties are the following. The first property is for all geometrical operators. All eigenvalues are discrete. And that is coming because they're obtained as the kind of Laplacians or some things on SU2. And these eigenvalues are all discrete. For the area operator, the eigenvalues are known in a closed form. If I had a transparency, I would just show you. Plot them out on a computer, just ask the computer to compute it in your formula, and you can keep going. And what one finds is that, in fact, the spectrum is rather complicated. It's not what you would have expected. Naively, you would have thought, well, it might be like a simple harmonic oscillator just going up like that. But that doesn't happen. The spectrum actually crowds. For larger eigenvalues, it crowds very much. In fact, for the something like up to one Planck length squared, up to one log Planck length squared, there are only 9 eigenvalues, while up to 2 Planck length squared, there are 99 eigenvalues. It just happened as an accident that this 9 and 99 thing. It really crowds very rapidly. And in fact, for very large areas, you can show that it actually crowds exponentially. So the spectrum is quite sophisticated. The third thing that happens, and this really may go back to a question that Joe was asking, that if I take two operators, a hat and a hat prime, in other words, you take two surfaces, and supposing the two surfaces actually intersect each other, then we want to take the commutator of this, and if they intersect with each other, then the commutator is not equal to 0. Now, what you can show is that the commutator is very, very small. It's like, but nonetheless, the commutator is not equal to 0. So, in general, in the full theory like that, the statement is that the metric representation, if you take this seriously, then the metric representation doesn't exist. Or the metric representation may exist, but then the area operators will have to be defined in a very subtle way, and maybe the regularization procedure will be such that it will say that the area operators don't commute with each other. Something subtle has to happen. The last thing that I wanted to say was that, well, there's also very interesting information about topology, for example. There is interesting information about topology of the two surfaces. You can look for the lowest eigenvalue of the area operator, like the area gap, like the mass gap that people look at in Hamiltonians and condensed matter physics or something. And the statement here is that the lowest eigenvalue is sensitive to the topology of the surface that we got. And so you can read off some information about the topology. So these are, so to say, geometric operators. Then we have to look at quantum Einstein equations. And in particular, we have to worry about the constraint equations. The physical states are not these states. This Hilbert space just enables us to write down the constraint operators in a mathematically precise form. And there are three types of constraints. There is, so to say, the Gauss constraint, which tells us that these internal rotations of the triads is pure gauge. Then there's a diffeomorphism constraint, which tells us that the diffeomorphisms of the three manifold are to be regarded as gauge. And then there's a Hamiltonian constraint, which gives us the time evolution. Now, the important thing is that this actually has enabled us to write down precise quantum operators, which actually correspond to this constraint. In the case of the Gauss and the diffeomorphism constraint, this can be imposed. You can find the states which are gauge invariant and which are diffeomorphism invariant. In this Hamiltonian constraint, there are many proposals. There are several proposals. One of the proposals that Kiemann made 5 years ago or so is most developed, but we do not have really a definitive candidate for the Hamiltonian constraint for the full theory so far, because in order to have this candidate, what we really need to show is the following. That solve this theory, and then we want to show that in that full theory, you have states which can be regarded as semi-classical states, which corresponds to the low-energy world that is around us. That is a big part of the program that, unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about. There's current work that is going on here. But we are not anywhere near finished there, and that is why. That is what is going to tell us whether any of these proposals is sensible, and if there are more than one, then what should we do with it, et cetera, et cetera. At the moment, what one has done is one has taken the form, the constraint that is given to us, and applied it to some simple models like cosmology and black holes, where there are enough other simplifications where we can actually look for semi-classical states, look if we got something reasonable physically, et cetera. And now the last remark I want to make is just a recent result. And this recent result may be, this is by a bunch of people. It is by Lewandowski and Okolov and Salman and Timan. There are three papers in various combinations. What they have shown is the following. There's a uniqueness result. We got these basic operators, and we got an algebra of these basic operators, which is given to you. And now what we want to do is, we want to find representations of this algebra. What has been done here is just to find a natural representation and develop the theory in this natural representation. Well, of course, when the theory is sufficiently mature, then somebody, of course, wants to come and say, well, but what about other representations? You know, how do the results depend on that? How do I know that this is the right representation? In fact, in quantum field, in Schrodinger quantum mechanics, there is only one representation. I've shown 1-9-1 theorem, all the representations are unitarily equivalent for quantum mechanics. And so we just live with it. But I want to return to this point when I deal with quantum cosmology. But in quantum field theory, we know that the canonical commutation relations have infinitely many representations. And the question is, which is the physical one? For example, the Fock representation is chosen by various symmetry requirements and so on. So what about here? So here the nice thing is that the results say that there exists a unique representation of the algebra, which we have been using. And this unique representation is the one that we've been using, such that it is cyclic. This is weaker than irreducible. It says that there is one state such that if you apply it repeatedly by the algebra, you will get the whole Hilbert space. And diffeomorphism covariant. So the cyclic state is actually diffeomorphism invariant. And this is quite strong result. I mean, we suspected something like that, but I had not expected that one would be able to actually prove this result in technical details. I mean, there are all these kinds of, I'm just telling you the main physical content of the theorem. You have to make some conditions, you have to introduce some conditions, like in the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem, about the domains of these operators, so that the commutation relations are all well defined, et cetera, et cetera. But apart from that, there is this very nice thing. So that says that, well, if you have a diffeomorphism invariant theory, which is based on connections and canonically conjugate momenta, maybe it's not, but if it is based on that, then in fact you don't have very much choice as to how you should go about doing quantum theory. You use this representation, and there's much more naturalness, there's much more forcefulness about choosing this particular representation. Okay, so now that brings me to the part with cosmology. So, and the interesting thing here, of course, is these are the questions which are sort of long-range questions, which have been open for a long time. You see, in any quantum gravity program, there are questions which are internal to the program, and there are questions which are sort of objectively sitting there, which all quantum gravity theories should address. An example of constraint of a problem which is internal to the program for us is a semi-classical limit. So we go and try to do everything in the Planck scale, and then we have got this huge burden to understand how the semi-classical states arise, how we make sense of ordinary quantum field theory in curved space-time, or in flat space-time, et cetera, et cetera. In string theory, similarly, I mean, one at a fundamental level, one is beginning in 10 or 11 dimensions, there is supersymmetry, the observed world doesn't have that, so how do you bridge this gap? So there are questions like this, which are in some sense approach-dependent questions. But there are questions like general relativity, we know to be a very good theory. We know the cosmological models, you know, give us solutions of Einstein's equation to very good accuracy. And we know that the theory predicts that there is singularity initially. What happens to that singularity? And in some sense, I think that any approach to quantum gravity has to address such questions. Second question is also a black hole question. That's why I selected these two, because these are questions which are in some sense universal questions. Everybody has to address them at some level or another. Okay, so that's the question that we want to sort of address. Now, sort of, I should say that this development in quantum cosmology is almost entirely the work of just one postdoc by name Martin Moyewald. And it's sort of about 2.5 years old, this work, another postdoc. and Martin just won this first gravity prize for the essay which summarized his results in quantum cosmology. When he came to Penn State, I did sort of tell him that discreteness of quantum geometry will lead to qualitative changes in quantum cosmology, how we expected things to happen, but all the detailed work from there, I mean, after these initial ideas, are completely his. Okay. So, what are the results in quantum cosmology? So I'll start with the first result, then give some details, and go to the second result, and so on. The first result that is the following. So, what is the setting, first of all? The setting that I'm going to use today is just homogeneous, isotropic, like Friedman-Robertson model. So, homogeneous and isotropic models with matter. The second thing that we'd like to know is sort of more general mini-super spaces, which are only homogeneous. So isotropy is required. And the more general, even more general, would be this kind of midi superspaces, in which, in this case, you only have finite number of degrees of freedom. Here you have got infinite number of degrees of freedom. So you allow certain kinds of homogeneities. And then finally, inhomogeneities. No, of course, there are no isotropies, but furthermore, certain kinds of inhomogeneities. And finally, of course, you would like to have full theory, full quantum gravity theory up here. So this has been analyzed in great detail. This has now, actually there are already papers on this thing. This is sort of really great detail. Midi superspaces, the work had just begun. A full theory, there is very little, really.
I mean, how do the discreteness and the reduction commute? I mean, do you write this thing in terms of the spin variables, and then is there some midi superspace reduction of that?
Right. So the way it is done is exactly what you said. So first you write down midi superspaces in terms of these variables. But then when you go to quantization,
So you reduce before quantizing.
But you could do the other way also, which I'll tell you. Yeah. First of all, the way that is actually done in detail is really do take the mini superspace, write down some intercepted collections in the triads up here. And then, however, when you go to quantum theory, you want wave functions to depend only on the holonomies.
Now, I mean, I thought the usual construction is sort of is very dependent on the three plus one dimensions, SU2 and so on. So is there
right.
some natural...
No, there are... Right.
So, once you reduce, is there a natural way to still carry it out?
Right. Because we're not reducing it to a point or something. They're just... They're reduced only in the sense that they're three-dimensional or four-dimensional space-times on which the fields are homogeneous and isotropic. Uh-huh. So that's the way this is reduced, basically.
So, I mean, one of these spin networks doesn't look very homogeneous as a
absolutely. Right? So therefore, all the spin networks, so only there will be, yeah, exactly. So you'll be left with only states which will have, I mean, for example, in the homogeneous isotropic case. Let's say homogeneous case, first of all, and then isotropic case. Then if I know what the holonomies are along, say, three curves like that, then I know the connection everywhere. So first you go and find out, you know, how do you characterize the connection? Why did we look at spin networks? We looked at spin networks because we're interested in holonomies. Spin networks were kind of... just a basis in a way, but the holonomy. So you look at functions of holonomies, right? So therefore the question is, how many holonomies do you need to characterize the connection? There's a question. And then you get a Hilbert space that is constructed out of it. But at every step, you keep an eye to what was done in the full theory, and you repeat those constructions. And therefore we're going to see in a minute that in fact, even though it's a finite dimension system, therefore it's ordinary quantum mechanics, you get a quantum description which is inequivalent to the standard Schrodinger description. And this is probably what you are getting at, which I'll explain in 1 minute. Okay. So that's what one is doing. And now I'll write down the first result and then use this result to explain the point that you were just asking about. The first result is the following, that you look at the curvature. Now we know that curvature goes like 1 upon scale factor in homogeneous isotropic model. So this all my 15 minutes worth are going to be in homogeneous isotropic models. I don't have time to do the other things. So the whole curvature just goes as 1 upon a squared up here. And therefore, classically, of course, at the Big Bang, a goes to 0 and curvature goes to infinity. And now what you want to know is, well, what happens to this corresponding quantum operators? That's what we want to know. The first remark is that, let me just write down the results, and then find it. But the first result is that quantum mechanically, a quantum loop quantum cosmology as it's called, loop quantum guide, the curvature is bounded from above. The particular scheme that we're using to define this curvature operator, there are factor ordering problems that they have not been resolved. These factor ordering problems change coefficients of the order of 1. You know, in other words, 1 can become 12, or 12 can become 9, et cetera, et cetera. But curvature is bounded from above. And the particular scheme that I like has curvature, which is given, the bound is just given by 12. No, this is for the, yes, 12 upon n squared. This is about 33 times 10 to the 56. Times the curvature at the horizon of a black hole of 1 solar mass. So it's huge, but the important thing is that it's actually bounded above. So it sort of seems funny, because classically, you had curvature as a function of A only. Here, curvature is bounded above. But on the other hand, the scale factor operator, or the volume operator of the universe, does go to 0. And furthermore, it is a normalized eigenvector. So it sounds funny. I mean, what is going on here? So first question you would like to ask is, well, is curvature a completely funny operator? Something happened? Well, the simple check that you can make, first of all, is that does this operator commute with this operator? And the answer is yes. So in some sense, it is, you know, it's very similar to the scale factor operator up here. Then you want to say, well, if that is the case, why don't I look at simultaneously diagonalize them and look at eigenvalues and see what happens? Curvature multiplied by the scale factor squared, right? I can take this curvature times the scale factor squared. Classically, I should get 1. What do I get up here? So you get 1 plus term of the order of L to the Planck line to the 4th upon A to the 4th. In other words, this curvature is like 1 upon A squared, very much like that, for large areas, for large scale factors. But when you come to, you know, the Planck line scale factor, then this is not no more the case. There are major deviations from here up here. And in fact, you can plot it. Again, I couldn't show it in the transparency. And you can see that, in fact, that major deviations occur only in the first 100 or so Planck lines. After that, this is clear from here. I mean, after that, this factor is, you know, 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 8. It's a very, very small factor up here. So I feel that to understand full quantum gravity effects, one would have to really understand this regime in loop quantum gravity of just a few Planck lines. I mean, and this is now numerically feasible because, I mean, 100 grid points is not too much. So one can actually do. So I think numerical relativity, numerical quantum geometry is really a ripe subject. And in fact, I hope it will be launched in full-fledged calculations in the near future. Now, how does this all about come about, and some of the questions that Joe was asking? Well, it came about as follows. You see, we have this finite dimensional system, but we follow the procedure. We follow the procedure that came from the full theory. So our wave functions are not going to be just functions of connections, for example, or of triads, but they're going to be functions of holonomies. And then, so we get non-standard quantum mechanics. So why do we get non-standard quantum mechanics, in which all such things can happen? Well, let's go back to just the standard Stone von Neumann theorem that we all know and love. And what happens in the standard von Neumann theorem? So von Neumann uniqueness theorem, it says the following, right? It says that we should look at these classical functions, u of lambda, u of mu, which is just e to the I mu x, and v of lambda, which is equal to e to the I lambda p, the exponentiated form, basically. And there are some points of brackets, and we want to take them over to the commutators. So the idea is that we'll in this uniqueness theorem, we have u hat of mu, v hat of lambda, and they satisfy some commutation relations, which are called the Heisenberg-Weil commutation relations. And then we just have to find out that's better. That's not better. Okay. So we just have to find out representations of these commutation relations. Now, usually we are sort of told that, well, there's a unique representation, which is the standard Schrodinger representation. Well, that's not true. What we need is you find the representations of this, and we ask that there should be continuity in mu and lambda. So these should be unitary operators, which are weakly continuous in u and lambda. Why do we ask that? Because we want the necessary and sufficient condition that these operators come from a self-adjoint, are generated by self-adjoint operators, is that they should be weakly continuous, and we want x and p to be well-defined. So weak continuity plus commutation relations tell us that there is a unique representation. There's a theorem, and that's it. What happens up here is that if you follow what is given to us by the general theory up here, and you repeat that procedure, then you are led to a representation of this algebra, which you can translate in these terms up here, which satisfies the commutation relations fine. V of lambda is actually weakly continuous, and therefore the momentum, which is like the E, exists. But U of mu is not weakly continuous, and therefore the connection actually doesn't exist. And this is a thing that happens also in the full theory. In the full theory, in our Hilbert space, holonomies are perfectly well-defined operators, but connections by themselves are not really well-defined operators. You don't have the continuity, and therefore the connections are not well-defined. And that comes up here. And as soon as you drop the requirement, this be weakly continuous, right? Suddenly, new representations become available, and these are representations which are doing the job. And that is why things happen here, which do not happen in ordinary Wheeler type of geometry dynamics. Okay. So let me just tell you one more result, and then go on to the next topic.
If you have more than one representation, what is the criteria?
Right. So the criteria was the uniqueness theorem that I told you before, namely, we have a uniqueness theorem in the full theory. In this particular case, we are choosing the representation following the procedure that was given to us by the full theory. So in this case, this is relatively recent, and so we're not looked at sort of uniqueness just within this context. You cannot use the criteria which is available to us in the full theory because these homogeneous isotropic models are not diffeomorphism invariant. There, the diffeomorphism invariant was a key factor up here. I do not know how to formulate it, uniqueness just within the theory, but that's what. Okay. But now one might ask, this is all very new and everything, but how do I know? How is it related to the usual kind of Wheeler-DeWitt equation and so on and so forth? So for that, we have to understand dynamics. This is just sort of a kinematical result in a way. And we have to understand the dynamics and see how the dynamics that will come from on this Hilbert space is going to be related to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation dynamics. And let me just tell you the result. The result is that indeed, if you restrict yourself to states where the universe is large, you just look at that part where the universe is very large, then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a great approximation to the fundamental evolution equation that I'm going to write down just now. In the language of numerical relativity or computational physics, the statement is that the equation that I'm going to write down right now is a rigorously permissible discretization of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is a differential equation. But of course, here the point of view is that the discrete equation is the fundamental one. The continuous equation is the approximate one up here. And this is done in two ways. One is looking at the equations, and then we also look at the solutions. What you can do is you can look at the solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for large A's, for large scale factors. And in that regime, you can see, are there equations, are there solutions to the fundamental equation? And the statement is there are approximate solutions to the fundamental equation, and you can actually tell precisely what the nature of approximation is. So this is where we're going, and that's the second result. Maybe then I won't have time to do more. So the second result is just the following, dynamics. So what we do is the following. We got geometry plus matter. Even in the full theory, there are precise prescriptions about how to quantize matter in the so-called polymer framework. And now what we do is we take the total wave function psi, and we write it as, just expand it out in terms of eigenbasis of the geometry operator, for example, like the scale factor operator, or the triad operator. And so you get summation over n, sine of phi, times n. So this is a geometry eigenvector, and the coefficient depends on the matter field, which I'm denoting by phi up here. And now, we have in the full theory a way to write down the quantum Hamiltonian constraint. We're just going to use the one that was given to us by Tiemann, the most developed one, and apply it here. So the quantum Hamiltonian constraint gives. So we use exactly the same procedure in this context and find out what happens. Well, what it does, of course, is that you apply it on this, and something is equal to 0. That's what you obtain at the quantum constraint. And that equation becomes an equation on this coefficient sign. Right? So what is the coefficient? You get a difference equation. You get sine plus 4 of phi plus some other alpha times that plus some the alpha, beta, etc. numerical coefficients, which are, of course, very important. But they depend on n also. Matter Hamiltonian operating on sine of phi. Okay. So this is what the constraint is. Now you can think of this as just being a constraint. It just says that only those sine, the infinite power of sine, is allowed in which this difference equation is obeyed. But as is usual with the Wheeler Davidi equation and so on, Wheeler Davidi equation, by the way, is a differential equation. It looks like something, I mean, in certain Packard ordering which is compatible with this, it looks like a minus 1 d by d a operating on the wave function is equal to the Hamiltonian operating on the wave function. The Wheeler Davidi equation, the wave function depends on the scale factor on phi, and you get a differential equation like that. Here we've got a differential equation, basically. And now, just as in this equation, you often like to think of A as being giving you a notion of time, and this is telling you how the wave function evolves. That is why one says that you've got a second order time evolution equation. So here also, you would like to say that, well, this n, which is really the eigenvalue of the scale factor or of this triad operator or volume operator, how the volume changes, we can say, well, this is how the universe makes jumps, right, from a state n to n plus 4. So if you give me what the value is as n and n minus 4, then I can actually tell you the value at n plus 4. Or you can evolve backward if you wanted. Give me this value and this value, then I'll tell you what this value is. Now, the key question is, what happens to the singularity? Singularity corresponds to zero volume. That corresponds to n equal to 0. So what happens to this equation? A priori, it could have happened that this equation just breaks down. These coefficients up here could have been such that the equation just breaks down, and you cannot evolve backwards. So what I'm trying to do is I'm going to try to evolve backwards and see what happens. But that doesn't happen. If I had more time, I would have told you some very, very nice properties of these coefficients, which are such that they actually permit us evolution right through the singularity. Of course, near the singularity, the quantum fluctuations are very large, and the notion of space-time that you may have completely breaks down. So figuratively, space-time actually dissolves near the singularity. You have to use the description, which is quantum description, not anchored in any space-time terms up here. And again, all these are sort of effects are significant only near any, only between n equal to 0 and n equal to 100 or so. After that, the evolution is well described by the Wheeler-Davidi equation that I was just writing down before. So the singularity is actually resolved in this case. And yet, so therefore, near Big Bang, quantum effects of this quantum mechanics are very different from the quantum mechanics of the Wheeler-Davidi equation. Wheeler-Davidi equation doesn't resolve the singularity. So near the Big Bang, there are major deviations from Wheeler-Davidi. But for large A, excellent matching. If you want to get a bird's eye view of all these results, I think the first 5 sections of this kind of review that they have written is good. It doesn't give too many details, but those of you who are more relativists, I mean, there are some issues which are kind of geometrical issues and really important issues, which were ignored by Martin in his earlier work, but they have been systematically addressed in this paper. It's called The Mathematical Structure of Hamiltonian of Loop Quantum Cosmology. And especially for those of you who are relativists, because when Martin was giving these talks, sort of prominent people, they always had certain objections about the way that he was doing things, and they really have been very neatly and systematically resolved in this other paper. So I just want to point out to the second paper for him. Now, there are a couple other things. One is about the about what happens about the initial the boundary conditions on the wave function. And the statement there is that for the simplest model, homogeneous isotropic cosmology, with, for example, just a cosmological constant, in that case, the Wheeler-Davidi equation normally, beginning second order, has 2 solutions. And somehow you have to do something, boundary condition, in order to cut one solution and get one solution up, and therefore it is unique up to normalization. Now, in that case, what happens is that when you actually apply this, look at this in great detail, what happens is that at n equal to 0, supposing I'm evolving back, so at n equal to 4. So I'm trying to decide, you are giving me the wave function in the future of n equal to 4, and I come at n equal to 4. And I would like to decide what happens at n equal to 4. So this will be psi 0, basically. N minus 4 will be 0 up here. And it will be given by these things up here. What happens is that this coefficient actually vanishes there. As a result, you get a constraint, which we do not know a priori from, so like a constraint on the wave function, which we do not know in the Vera-De-Witt case. And if you apply this constraint, then in that case, you get a unique wave function. And the nice result there is that the question is, then what is it? I mean, is it close to which proposal? Is it the Balanchine proposal or Hartle-Hawking proposal, etc.? And in that case, it is very close to Hartle-Hawking proposal, of course, at late times. I mean, at the early times, there are departures because it's not a Vera-De-Witt equation at all. And this is a very recent result, and it's also discussed in this review of that. There are some issues about phenomenology having to do with inflation and so on, but I think I should stop, and I should just go to the black holes. Can I go to the black holes, or is it too? Okay. I'll be quick here. It will not be as detailed. So there's been a lot of excitement, because first of all, this is some very limited evidence, but this is a little bit of evidence that the Hamiltonian constraint that was proposed by Tiemann, at least in this mini superspace context, and also the mini superspace context, these two mini superspace contexts, actually gives you very interesting and physically nice results. I mean, here's a lot of work really was required in order to really get away from this intuitive feeling, right? But it's quantum mechanics. If it's quantum mechanics, how can it be different? And this careful work that in fact it can be different is what took at least a lot of work in terms of clarity. Last thing that I want to talk about is really black holes. And here I'll be quicker because I'm running out of time up here. And the statement is the following, basically. So for the longest time, as we know, that we have got this puzzle about black hole entropy. Now, already in the last workshop, last time there was a big workshop here on general relativity, I think it was 99, this problem was resolved in a certain sense. And now what has happened recently is really generalizing those results. So I'm not going to give you great details. I'll just tell you very structurally what has happened and where we are. So the question is really, can you get a statistical mechanical derivation of black hole entropy? So the starting point up here is isolated horizon. This is what I mentioned or discussed in some detail last week in the context of classical general relativity. And in fact, the isolated horizons were first introduced because we wanted an arena in which we could discuss the black hole entropy problem, an arena which is tailored to quantum geometry. That is how it was really began to begin. But then it has had all these applications just to classical, say, numerical relativity and so on. The isolated horizons are, they come in two types. One is type one. Well, I would like to restrict myself to these two types. And type one are, technically, they are non-distorted and non-rotating. The intrinsic geometry of the horizon is spherical. This doesn't mean that it is only Schwarzschild. There are isolated horizons of type 1 in which there are no killing vectors outside. Just the intrinsic geometry is spherical. And the second thing is type 2, in which it is axis symmetric. You could consider more general, but these are the physically most interesting ones. The intrinsic geometry is acceleration. So what was done previously was really looked at this type 1 isolated horizon, and we wanted to construct a quantum mechanical description of a type 1 isolated horizon. And this is the work that was done in collaboration with John Baez and Kirill Krasnov. And to understand the entropy, we wanted to know what is the intrinsic geometry of the horizon. So here is a picture of the horizon. So basically what we're doing is we're looking at exterior region. So you've got some space-time, and you've got a horizon up here. Here is a space-like surface. Here is another space-like surface. This is a time-like world cube at infinity. And here we've got M1 and M2. Right? These are two surfaces. And this. And what we're doing is we're really looking at system defined in this particular way. We're looking at the phase space And then we're going over to the quantum geometry. So we have the Hamiltonian framework. Classical Hamiltonian framework, and we go to quantum geometry. But certain things change. If you have this internal boundary, which is isolated horizon of type 1, then what happens is that when you look at this gravitational Poisson bracket, so symplectic structure, the total symplectic structure, this is gravitational, you get the usual bulk term, which will just say that A and E are canonically conjugate, or a metric and extrinsic curvature canonically conjugate. But there is also a certain surface term. And this surface term is just living on these isolated horizons, and that is coming from the boundary conditions up here. So this sphere up here is really this little point up here. It is the intersection of the Cauchy surface with the isolated horizon. And this picture that I'm drawing up here is now just this Cauchy surface with the inner boundary, which is this isolated horizon. So now, we look at this surface term, and we find two things. That we find that this surface term that we got here is exactly that of so-called U1 Chern-Simons theory. So therefore, in quantum geometry, what happens is that you have got bulk excitations of geometry, which are described by this polymer geometry that I discussed before. But in addition to that, you've got an inner boundary, and you have to describe the horizon states, the quantum geometry of the inner boundary up here. And these horizon states are then described by Chern-Simons theory because the symplectic structure came from the Chern-Simons theory up here. And then the statement is that, well, so that's the idea up here. So to begin with, you have in quantum theory then, you've got these Hilbert spaces, the bulk one and the surface one. We get the total Hilbert space, which is given by bulk one, surface one. And then, over here, in the classical theory, not only the symplectic structure modified, of course it is, but of course there are also isolated horizon, or horizon boundary conditions, let me just call it. There are some horizon boundary conditions up here. And of course, we have incorporated part of them, because we got the Chern-Simons, because we do this with the U1 Chern-Simons theory. But not all of them. We have not incorporated all of them. There is still non-trivial information which says that this is not any old surface. It is actually isolated horizon. And therefore, this horizon boundary condition we have got goes to a quantum horizon boundary condition, which is an operator equation. What this operator equation tells us, and the statement is that, so let me just call it some operator equation, boundary conditions, let me call it B. And so basically, we're saying that only those states are allowed, only those, for those states it will be true that this will be the analog of the quantum analog of the isolated horizon for which this boundary condition is satisfied. And the key idea up here is that this boundary condition is actually of the following type. So B psi is of the following type. There is going to be a bulk operator, so let me call it O bulk times identity, plus there is an identity times O surface operating at psi is equal to 0. There are two operators up here. The surface operator, by the way, is just the Chern-Simons curvature, and the bulk operator is coming just from this triad that we got up here, evaluated on that surface, smeared on that surface. And now there is a problem, namely, are there enough solutions to this equation? If you have an equation of this type, then there will be enough solutions to this equation, if and only if you have got this bulk operator operates up here, surface operators operators here, if and only if the eigenvalues of the bulk operator and the eigenvalues of the surface operator are the same. So you've got infinitely many eigenvalues, and you have to calculate them, and are they the same? Now the funny part here is that the surface operator refers only to the Chern-Simons curvature, and therefore you can calculate it on the Chern-Simons Hilbert space. I can just give it to somebody who has never heard of black holes, and they can calculate it. The bulk operator, similarly, just refers to quantum geometry in the bulk, and I can give this to somebody who has never heard of Chern-Simons theory, and they can calculate these eigenvalues. The two operators are quite distinct. And so a very non-trivial result, and the most intricate matching that happens, is that the two sets of eigenvalues are the same. And that comes about because the level of the Chern-Simons theory is given by area upon 4 pi Planck length squared. I don't get the number right here probably. But. So there's a level of the Chern-Simons theory up here, which knows about this thing, surface Hilbert space, but it also knows about A, and this area information is something that the triad operator is sensitive to. So this was a very non-trivial check. If this had failed, it would have meant that in quantum geometry, at least in this way of doing isolated horizons, there was no unified description. And now, so this worked, and then one counted, and I think there are many technical things, but I don't want to go into that. And one got entropy proportional to the area, as one wanted. Okay. Now the two new things are the following, two results. The first result is really incorporation of type 2, incorporation of distortion and rotation. So for example, if you have black holes, which are rotating and distorted in general, they don't have to be curved. And they can be one of the solutions that, for example, that Jim Hartle and Bob Geroch found, which are distorted black holes. Okay, and because there may be matter fields outside, they're in equilibrium. They're so static, so they're in equilibrium. And so we would like to have this framework applied to the horizon of such black holes as well. And so that is to say type 2 black holes. And this was done. And this is also discussed in this. The whole thing is discussed, but in particular with emphasis to this extension to type 2. And the second thing that was done was the following. What about non-minimal couplings? See, already here, the imposing of this boundary condition was very subtle, but it turns out to work exactly right. What about non-minimal couplings? So let me just spend, you know, the 5 minutes on this, and then I'll split. So why should we be interested in non-minimal coupling? Well, we should be interested in that because it is a kind of a puzzle that comes up. Namely, if you have a gravitational Lagrangian, right, which is given by square root of minus g times the scalar curvature, some function times the scalar curvature, plus scalar field. So supposing you are given a gravitational Lagrangian like that, then one can say that you have got a theory with a non-minimally coupled scalar field. We can look at classical theory and look at the first law and try to see what the expression of the entropy is. Now, if it's minimal coupling, we know that the entropy doesn't depend on the matter field. It is just given by the area. But for the non-minimal coupling, it is not the case. This was first done by Jacobson and Myers, and almost immediately after by Wald and Iyer. And we recently extended their framework to isolated horizons because our starting point of quantum calculation was isolated horizons. So first we had to extend it to isolated horizons, and that has been done. And what the first law says is that the entropy should really be given by 1/4 times area, which is a usual thing, times. Plus integral of f of I as a numerical factor. There's no one called A. That's what's puzzling me. It's given about that, where this scalar field is evaluated now on the black hole horizon. So if say in this simple case of even type 1 horizon, where the scalar field will be constant, even then, the entropy is given by 1 upon 4 Lp squared times f of phi naught times area. So it's not given just by area. There's a matter field dependence up here. Now, at first, this looked like a disaster for quantum geometry. And this was the real challenge to quantum geometry. Bob Wald asked me this question, I think in June, last June. What about this case? Can one do this? And it seemed like a disaster because it looked like, well, quantum geometry, all this discreteness refers to this area, not the matter fields. And how can it be that one can actually get a formula like that and get in particular, satisfy these very delicate boundary conditions we have, et cetera, et cetera. So what happens is there are two things that happen in this case. The first thing is that when you do the Hamiltonian analysis, then you do have a surface term. There is, in fact, a Chern-Simons term. But whereas Chern-Simons term depended only on the area of the black hole previously, now the Chern-Simons coupling constant, when you do the Hamiltonian framework, you do get a Chern-Simons symplectic structure up here, just for the gravitational field. But the coupling constant depends on A naught upon 4 pi p squared times f of I naught up here. So now the coupling constant depends on whatever the value of the phi naught that you may have. And the second thing that happens, which is more interesting in a way, is that now we have the gravitational connection. This is a gravitational. And we've got the canonically conjugate object, pi. And the canonically conjugate object now is not just given by E, the triad, but is in fact f of phi times E. But now in this quantum geometry that we're talking about, I was really talking about the momentum which is conjugate to the connection, h bar by delta by delta A. So it's really the eigenvalues of pi which are all discrete, okay, and so on. I mean, not eigenvalues of E. E has to be, eigenvalues of E have to be recovered from eigenvalues of pi using this particular equation. But what happens beautifully is that the horizon, these two factors just combine right, so that this factor changed and that the eigenvalues of pi are not the same as eigenvalues of E, but there's this factor f of phi in there, that in fact this horizon boundary condition still continues to be true and you get the final result. Now those of you who know the details of the entropy calculations, for the type 1 case, in order to get the factor 1 upon 4, we have to fix the so-called Barbieri-Mirzi parameter, which is a quantization ambiguity. Here, there's a whole new topic, so I'll just tell you to those of you who know. And the key question now was, well, what about incorporation of distortion and rotations? What about non-minimal couplings? In this case, is the value the same or is it not the same? And the answer was that the values are really the same. So again, what I'm trying to do here is to give you illustrated examples of the kind of work that is being done. There's a lot of work in two other areas. One I mentioned tangentially, which is bridging the gap between low energy physics and Planck scale physics. And this will be discussed in some detail in this review that we are writing. That part is actually already written. And the other part, which is really a big subject, which is called spin forms, which is basically a Feynman path integral approach to quantum geometry. So it combines topological quantum field theories and states some models and general relativity. But spin forms at the moment is primarily at a mathematical stage of development. In my view, not enough physics has come out of it yet, and therefore I did not really include it here. Thank you. There is self-consistent quantization, but it's a quantum sector which does not seem to agree with quantum field theory in curved space-time results, for example. So you do not have good semi-classical results.
Wouldn't it be a kind of a philosophical problem that you expected, if you did have a self-consistent theory, would you expect to be able to derive all of the semi-classical stuff from the quantum theory? So, I guess I'm asking.
So if you put that into it, I was trying to draw a distinction. I was drawing a distinction. Is the theory mathematically self-consistent? I can give you an example if you like. And the second is, does it have right semi-classical thing? I mean, for example, if I have spin 1/2 system, it is mathematically, we all know, it's mathematically completely self-consistent. I can take a phase space to the two sphere. Yeah. There's no configuration space. There's no X operator. There's no P operator. But we have quantum theory. But it does not have a classical limit. Wow. There's no classical phase space, et cetera, that from which I can construct this. I mean, there's no configuration space. There's no cotangent bundle, et cetera, et cetera. So, by self-consistently, is it a mathematically self-consistent quantum theory? It seems to me it is. We've not seen any problem with it. Will it have the right semi-classical limit? Well, it will have the right classical limit because the parameter just washes out in the classical theory. It doesn't matter at all. But it does not seem to have right semi-classical limit. That is to say, results from quantum field theory in curved space-times. And now philosophically, it's like theta parameter.
The idea of having many graphs and having bounds on it seems very natural. Why do you have to have different representations? What do those correspond to? What happens if you restricted yourself just to spin half representation?
Or here, you will get only subset of all states, right? I mean, you'll not get all possible states. In other words, it's not true. To begin with, we had a kind of, we had this Hilbert space, total Hilbert space, and well, as I was saying, this total Hilbert space is just given by direct sum of graph and J's, H, J. So if you just restricted yourself this to be just one half, I would just get a small subspace of this.
Yeah,
I would not get
the
whole.
That doesn't give you this.
Because if you take these operators, So if you take these operators, then the momentum operator actually is fine. It will, but the holonomy operators will map you out of that subspace. So that's how we know that.
There are claims that loop quantum gravity creates a variable speed of light. Now, it seems surprising that you start with general relativity and relativity end up losing special relativity. And I was wondering if you have an opinion on this.
Can I switch this off? No, I think things that are done here are very heuristic. There are all kinds of inputs there, which may be right ultimately. I'm not saying that they're wrong by any means. I mean, but it is far from being demonstrated that they are right. So my viewpoint is that, in fact, I personally, this is a completely personal viewpoint. It has nothing to do with deep calculations, but just feelings that you get from looking at the results and so on, that calculation that I have done, I don't think there will be any result at the order that they are talking about, which is the leading order thing. Whether there is a result in the second order, I do not know. In other words, at the order of Planck length, you know what I mean, second order in energy of the.
There was a claim that there was a first order, 1 over Planck?
Yeah, you know, there are claims like that, which are. But I don't think that, I think mainstream, I shouldn't say it. I mean, most people would take it with a, saying that, I mean, people should be thinking about provocative ideas, and of course, first time around, you can't do things carefully and so on. But I think one shouldn't take the results so carefully then either, and I think that's the main.
Okay, that's